Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Welcome to Space Junk. My name is Annie Hanmer, and I study international space cooperation, space treaties, and space debris at the University of Sydney's School of History and Philosophy of Science. Stephen Freeland is one of Australia's leading international lawyers and the Dean of Law at Western Sydney University. He has published countless works on the subject of international space law and represents Australia at international space meetings. Stephen and I recorded this podcast over cups of tea and cookies and had such a fascinating, wide-ranging and philosophical conversation that it took me a few days to get my brain to slow down enough to remember to upload it. I hope you enjoy listening. Stephen has nominated Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries to begin and end this podcast. This version is performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Daniel Barenboim at the Berlin State Opera House in 1998. Enjoy. I'm sitting down with Professor Stephen Freeland, who is the Dean of Law at Western Sydney University. Stephen, it's lovely to talk to you. Thank you for agreeing to make time to chat about space today.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for bringing cookies along for us to eat while we chat. And to your listeners, they are great.
So, Stephen, you are, it would, I think, be fair to say, perhaps Australia's most famous space lawyer. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what it is that you do as a space lawyer, and then in the rest of your life as well, what is it that you do?
Well, thank you firstly for that introduction. There's probably a few other people around who might contest that, but that's okay. There are not many people around. So, if you walk down the street and you ask people about space, maybe it's changing a bit now, but they would their conception of what you're talking about would be limited to perhaps planets and aliens and rockets and things like that. But when you then sit them down, as I'm sure you have with many of your friends, and spoken to them about how we utilize space every day. So it's ubiquitous in our lives. We use it so many ways every day. That gets people thinking about, well, there must be something to this. And then when you interplay above that, all of the elements of space, how it's an incredibly large commercial space, how it's incredibly large from a scientific viewpoint. And of course, as you dive down even more, how it's a reflection of humanity and how we look going forward. It's a militarized space or used for military purposes. It's for exploration, it's strategic, it's economic, it's cultural, it's so many things. And then you begin to realize that whatever happens in space has impacts on so many people, let alone economies and communities and countries. And because of that, it's necessary to have some rules of the road. So if you drill down like that, quite quickly you'll come up with a conclusion that you need to have some law to drive all of this. So space lawyers, if you like, are involved in interpreting, applying, making suggestions about future development of the rules that guide all of these activities in space. So that sounds simple, but it's quite complex because we do so many things in space, and as I've said, space is so multifaceted anyway. So what I do is I have the privilege of teaching. So I teach space law to students, and I've been doing that for a long time. There have probably been about 2,000 or 3,000 students of mine in the last 20 years who have studied space law all around the world. I consult, I work with industries more and more who are engaged in some form of space activity upstream or downstream and are interested in the regulatory frameworks. I work with governments. I had the privilege of working for the Australian government in a couple of ways, to help in the reform of our domestic space law, to help in the drafting of documents that ultimately led to the establishment of the Space Agency, and represent Australia as part of the Australian delegation at UN meetings on space. And then I work with the United Nations and the international community looking at the future, looking at the developments in technology, what they mean for what we can do in space. And even though the law will never, ever, ever keep up with developments in technology, and in my view, neither should it, because the technology continually changes and law is hard to change once you have established it. But looking at how in the future, for the benefit of all of us and to maximise what incredible things space can give to us, how we should develop regulatory rules of the road, frameworks, binding treaties perhaps, guidelines, codes of practice, really trying to develop responsible behaviour in space. And by and large, despite some errors, we've been reasonably responsible in space. Space has worked over the last 60 years, but there are some real challenges, and no doubt we'll talk a bit about that over the next few minutes.
So to take a step back for listeners who are not necessarily familiar with space law as a concept even, can we start with what is international law and how would you say it differs from domestic law that we'd be more familiar with?
Sure. So generally when you look at law, you can look at different levels of law, although not every country does this. But in Australia, for example, we essentially have a dualistic approach. We look at two different levels of law. So there's a layer of law that we call international law. And even though it's much more than this, what I simplistically say is it's law made by countries. We call countries states at international law. So law made by states for states. So as the world became increasingly more international, and then using later nomenclature globalized due to developments in technology, countries had to deal with each other more and more. And to deal with each other, even if you didn't like each other, you had to establish rules of the road as to how your behavior would be towards each other. So international law drives those relationships. International law as we know it really began in the 15th and 16th centuries with the development of technology. I mean, law really is a reactor to technology, and certainly in the international space. And in that case, it was the development of shipping technology, and particularly from Northern Europe, So you had the Dutch and the British and the French and the Portuguese and the Spanish beginning to go literally outside of their domains. And laws had to begin to be developed so as to work out the relationships. And of course, that's a very simplistic start, but it gave rise to some really fundamental principles that we even now adhere to, which is a respect for equality of countries, not in a practical sense, because there are powerful countries and less powerful, but in a legal sense, there's a sovereign equality, a respect for territory and the jurisdiction that countries have over their territory and their vessels and now rockets, of course, satellites. So international law is that relationship at the international level between countries. National law, domestic law, which you also asked about, is on a different plane, and that's the law that countries themselves pass in accordance with their own parliamentary processes and constitution that dictates a different relationship, a relationship between the state, the country, and its own people. And so that is a vertical relationship, whereas and it doesn't typically, although different people have different theories about this, but it typically doesn't intersect directly with this horizontal relationship of the relationship between countries where there's that international law. But clearly there are overlaps. There are overlaps in content. There are overlaps in concepts about the nature of law. I mean, law is to be respected and looked at in a binding way. But typically in countries like Australia, and so most countries with this, as I call it, dualistic view, so Australia would have all these relationships at the international level based on, let's say, treaties, which are very relevant for the idea of space. There are a lot of space treaties. All these relationships Australia would have with all these other countries, giving rise to rights and obligations for Australia. And then Australia would choose how it wants to translate that into the way that it regulates the activities of those within its jurisdiction under its national law. So, for example, space law, and Australia is a party to the relevant instruments, space law creates obligations on countries essentially to encourage responsible behaviour in space by its citizens in the way that it supervises their activities. And then countries like Australia then pass domestic law where they set out a framework for its citizens to comply with in their space activities.
Something I find very interesting about international law as opposed to domestic law is that it's a real opt-in system. So there's a difference there in the way that countries can choose to form rules and regulations by which they will all be held for presumably some sort of common good, rather than there being a higher body or a higher court to which they are held. With the exception, I understand, in international law of certain principles, there is this general sense that international law has only the power that people choose to give it or that decision makers choose to give it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's a really astute observation. I'd probably put it slightly differently, but I think we reach the same conclusion. So think of it this way. As I said, international law governs the relationship between states. In the beginning, it was about commerce and trade, and it still is, of course. Mm. But over time, it's about so many things. And to a certain degree, the rights and obligations that states have under international law somehow might restrict the way that they can regulate you when you're born. So the area of human rights law is often quoted as the example. So there are some international human rights standards. Countries are bound by that, and therefore they can't pass domestic... I mean, they pass domestic laws which say they can torture you or something, but that's clearly something that international law would say is wrong, and it therefore impinges on their ability to do that, because the way the world works is it's still based on this territorial notion that states are within their territory omnipotent. And international law, I always say what international law is. You know, I draw a picture of Pac-Man on the board. And we all remember the idea of Pac-Man coming along and eating things. I remember a washing powder ad when I was young about washing powder and this Pac-Man eating all the globs of dirt. And I draw Pac-Man and then I write the word sovereignty. And for me, international law is Pac-Man eating up this notion of sovereignty, which was born in the 1500s and 1600s, and at that time said, we can do whatever we want within our territory to those citizens like you. Mm. And over time, international law says, well, you are still the power in your territory, but there are certain standards that international law will impose on you. And so that's what international law is doing. It's eating up sovereignty and, in a sense, if you'll pardon the analogy, spitting it out in a different way, redefining sovereignty. And so, what does that mean? States typically don't like international law. It is a perception that it's an interference in what they can do. They love the idea of doing whatever they want within their own territory. It's an interference, it's an imposition of standards, it gives rise, as you said, to some accountability, and therefore they're suspicious of international law. Therefore, remember what I said, it's law made by states for states. So it was initially conceived by states that we don't like this thing, but we need it because we've got to deal with people. We've got to have rules on the road. We want to make money. We want to trade. We want to conquer. We want to have wars. Whatever, we need to have some rules to govern that. We're suspicious of international law, and therefore we will construct this regime in a way that we can pick and choose what we're bound by, which is the point you're making. And that was, in a sense, the original and, for many, still the major premise upon which international law is based. I would say, though, that whilst that's still important, because states can choose which treaties they sign up to, international law has become more and more prevailing. And there are certain concepts, you referred to it yourself, but I think it's broader than just notions of thou shalt not commit genocide and thou shalt not torture, I mean, which are incredibly important, don't get me wrong. But I think international law is pervading now more and more, such that states, even if they don't like it, have some sense of obligation under it. So they can't pick and choose exactly what they want now.
You could think about international law as a kind of system of ethics or morals which exert some influence over individual decisions. People have rights to behave as they wish to behave, but that those rights are curtailed in the way that they affect others. And there are legal ways that that happens, but there are also forces that are socially constructed within society around ethics and morality that determine how we treat each other. That obviously gets disrupted to a degree if someone comes along who has a different view of things, and dare I say, America first, then you have a challenge set up. And the question is, to what extent is international law equipped to deal with someone who chooses not to play by its rules?
Again, I mean, that's a really perceptive observation. You started off by saying international law. Maybe you could extend that as an argument to law in general, but you said international law is a reflection of ethics and morality. I think we wish it was, but law at the domestic level, let alone the international level, is not necessarily a reflection. You would hope it's a reflection of the greater societal values, and those values reflect what we would regard as moralistic values, ethical values. But my morals and ethics will perhaps be different from your morals and ethics. And so it's very difficult to say that law always will be a reflection of morals and ethics. And in fact, again, as much as we would like that to be the case, that's a trap for young players to a certain degree to think that. And at the international level, it's even harder, because once we have this international system, once we realise, notwithstanding what I said before about states being suspicious of international law, the system they create encourages to inclusiveness.
Mm.
So we would much rather have countries we don't necessarily like, but more and more countries involved in a regime, because there are then rules of the road. But of course, to encourage greater inclusiveness, compromises are made. And so international law can never be a reflection of, you know, except in cases like thou shalt not commit a genocide, you know, obvious cases. But international law is about so many things. It can never be a reflection of all-pervasive culture or set of values or morals, because the world is so diverse, and yet we want inclusiveness. So, therefore, the legal system that we have, you know, I often give lectures to first-year students about international law, and my last lecture, the revision lecture before the exam, that's when they all come, is just two slides: the strengths of international law and the weaknesses of international law. And the strengths and the weaknesses are often the same thing. And one of them is the flexibility, the grey areas. So people, when you talk to political scientists, they say, well, international law is nothing. United States or Russia or China or anyone can do whatever they want and there's no legal sanctions. That's incorrect. But on the other hand, there's not necessarily one answer. We were talking before this podcast, you were saying about science. Science not being definitive in the answer. Well, international law is not necessarily definitive. A lot of it is interpretive. But it works.
It gives us a shared platform on which to have a conversation we can understand each other on.
Exactly.
And it provides commensurability between potentially divergent, what we might call thought collectives or ways of thinking.
Absolutely. And if you have flexibility, again, that's a weakness, because there's some uncertainty, there's wiggle room, there's grey areas. But it's also a plus, because it does allow for some shift. I'm not saying there aren't clear principles. There clearly are.
Mm.
But there perhaps are different ways of interpreting. But when you think about it, again, another thing that people are quick to judge international law, because international law works brilliantly 95.6237% of the time, right? It's the difficult, whatever it is, 4.123% that's in the newspapers, that's on the news, that perhaps is a reflection of when countries want to beat each other up or colonize or something. You know, the really difficult issues. There we struggle, because these vested interests and these different ideas of culture and history and so many issues mean that we're going to have different ideas about that. But by and large, the system works.
Yes.
By and large, the system works. There are so many things that you and I can do seamlessly that we can only do because of international law. So it's easy to be critical, and there are many things to criticize. But as a system, notwithstanding the suspicions that states have and notwithstanding the cynicism that individuals have, it actually is a system. I mean, I believe in it with all its flaws. It's a system that brings us to a better place, because without that you really would have might is right. I mean, in a much more stark way than perhaps we have now.
It's funny. So in my research, I often look at international law as a technology and say that it's a technology that can be invoked or excluded or used by nations in order to justify their behaviour or criticise others' behaviour. So it is really interesting to think about how international law and law itself has changed as we have changed as a society, as travel has brought us closer, as technology has enabled us to become more globalised. And perhaps some of the growing perception of challenge to international law that we've experienced over the last few years and will continue to experience are because the internet and social media and platforms like that, other technologies, are bringing us closer together, causing us to be even more globalised. We saw this in the India-Pakistan conflict that was occurring in the last week, that you had people on Twitter from both sides, citizens from both countries, talking to each other on Twitter about it and sort of hashtagging, let's not go to war, or let's go to war, or whatever they felt. That in itself is a remarkable difference from where the world was 50 years ago, when a lot of the treaties that we rely on in space, for example, were formed. Do you think that law needs to adapt again and become more complex, or there needs to be more of it? Or do you think it's got a strength in that it can be interpreted in different ways, as you say?
I think it's both. I mean, I think law has a great strength. It has an inherent strength for what it is, and it has an inherent strength, particularly at the international level, for its adaptability. And so in the space arena, we have, as you said, some fundamental principles that arise initially from the United Nations and then through some treaty instruments that have served us really well. Notwithstanding, there are some issues, no doubt, and challenges, but have served us really well since Sputnik. And you'll know that I'm a Sputnik baby. So
yes.
So born in
57.
That's right. So it's interesting to see that law does adapt, but it's never going to keep up with technology. It is reactive, as I said before, to technology. It does, however, have a resilience, because if I said to you, and this gets back to your question before about morals and ethics, if I said, Annie, what you did was unethical or immoral, you know, you'd be upset by that, but you'd probably could put live with it, because you would say, well, my morals are different to your morals anyway. You're judging me by the standards that I don't adhere to, or whatever. But if I said to you, Annie, what you did was illegal, unlawful, you wouldn't accept that. You couldn't accept that. That would bite at you in a different way. Law has that inherent strength. So it is at the international level. That's why the flexibility is important, not to encourage irresponsible behaviour, but when states then are deemed or regarded by a broad range of other actors, or by courts, if it ever gets to that, to have actually committed an unlawful act, then that has real strength to it, and states always resile from that. So your point about international law being subject to one's own interpretation, of course it is. Of course it is. And I will read a treaty, and you will read a treaty, and we might have different interpretations, and we might act upon our own interpretations. And that's fine, but if we ever have a dispute on that interpretation, and if we both have the political will to try to resolve that dispute in a court of law, then in the end, those mechanisms exist. So it gives me the flexibility to act, but it also gives me the obligations towards you, and you the rights and obligations with me. And if I go somewhere beyond where you think is acceptable, you do have rights. It's a political decision. You know, for Australia to take Japan to the International Court of Justice, as it did on the whaling case, right? When that happened, I wrote a lot of articles about that, saying I thought it was a mistake to do that, even though, you know, personally, of course, you know, I think whaling is something that should be completely stopped. But I thought the idea of going to a court and getting a definitive decision on that particular narrow point that Australia was asking about, all that did was open up, you know, once you've got that definitive decision, then it allows the other country to take advantage of that by going outside of the scope of that decision.
Yes, so you narrow the meaning of the law through
exactly.
a decision, and
exactly.
then there's opportunities to skirt that law.
Exactly, and whereas without that, sure, you don't have the definitive answer that people strive for when they're doing a mathematics formula, but on the other hand, you've got this ability to sit down and talk to each other.
Yes,
and you have scope to talk to each other, and in the end, international law, state made by states for states, they don't want it to be too strong to threaten themselves. And you know, I think that's really important. The other point I wanted to make about what you were saying is that talking about the comment on Twitter.
Sure.
So I had the privilege of working, as well as doing a lot of space law work, I was privileged to work with the International Criminal Court for quite some years, working with some judges at the International Criminal Court and in its early days when it was really making some landmark decisions. And the International Criminal Court was established in the late 1990s, and it was a reflection of things that were happening that society could no longer accept, atrocities. But the one point that really pushed society forward was technology, and indeed space technology, because in the 1990s, we could, for the first time, see the atrocities as they happened because of satellite communication. And therefore, that galvanizes us all. You know, you're too young, but I can remember seeing those atrocities. I can remember seeing the satellite communication imagery from East Timor after the independence vote, but before it became independent. And we saw some of the horrible things that were happening there. And people were crying in the street because they were seeing live these horrible things happening. And more technology allows us, as you say, to think, to be more globalized, even if we sit in our armchair, because we can see things as they happen. Mm. And that gives us a greater voice in wanting change and wanting accountability, be it for atrocities or whatever. And that demands law. And so the technology pushes the law in that regard, but the law also reacts to the technology. It's a two-way street. It's quite interesting, though, but technology and space technology has really changed our lives, not just in the way we use space, but the way we think, our ability to comprehend what and see what things are happening that we would have no other conception about unless it was for this technology.
Well, this is why I think it is so irresponsible of people to talk about space as a warfighting domain or to start talking about Space Force or anything to do with weaponizing space, because space is not just a place. It also exists on a symbolic level.
Absolutely.
But it also exists as a vital infrastructure to the way that we live our lives now. So to talk about having any sort of war fighting occurring in space is almost, to my mind, the equivalent of discussing the possibility of, setting off like bomb testing at Warragamba Dam. You'd have to be mad. The whole of our city depends on that piece of vital infrastructure. And space is just the same. The networks of satellites and the relative safety from debris, bearing in mind that that is a risk, but one that at the moment is relatively manageable and could very easily not be manageable, means that, to me, it reminds me very much of discussions of mutually assured destruction with nuclear weaponry. So this idea of, of course, if you fire it, I fire it. Well, it's the same in space. If you fire something kinetic at something big enough, then you've really messed up space for generations to come. And that is a huge risk. And I think that talking about space as if that's a possibility or something we could even consider within our strategic approach to it, it does a great disservice to all of the people in the world who rely on it.
Completely. I agree with every word, and you know that, like you, I've been very vocal on this issue, and there are elements of society that disagree with that view and my view, but I think the view that you've expressed so eloquently is exactly the view that we must keep on expressing. Mm. Obviously, as I said at the beginning, space has been used for military purposes almost from day one, and there are historical reasons for that, because Sputnik, 2 months after I was born, I mean, we're in the midst of the Cold War. This technology is a development from rocket technology, which was weapons technology in the Second World War. we had two protagonists who happened to be the only two countries who had space capability. They were staring each other in the eyes. They were having all these hot wars in other places. The technology was, of course, developed for military, with military eyes and strategic eyes and chest-beating eyes, if you know, what I mean, to show that not only can we do this, but if we can do this, we want you to think we can do a whole bunch of other things as well. And this space race was strategic, and it was military, and it was political. So we understand that space has a military component, and indeed wars on Earth involve the use of space technology. It's sad but true. It's a given, and notwithstanding anything we could say, we can't stop that. But it's a totally different dimension, as you say, to then extrapolate from that and say, well, space is just like any other area. And if I choose to fight my war in space, then I'm free to do that because I'm free to fight my wars on land and sea and air and all of that. So, and I think you and I agree, although not putting words in your mouth, that space is different. And that's not a naive notion. It's different because it's a reflection of humanity, and it's a function of the way humanity survives and all of the things you've said. But the other point is that you're right. As one increases rhetoric on this point, I gave a speech recently overseas where somebody was asking me about Space Force and what did I think, and I gave a rather silly analogy of, imagine you have a whole bunch of kids in the room, and you say to them, let's go outside and play outside with the group next door, and little Johnny says yes, and Charlotte says that'd be nice, and you know, but they're all meek and mild, and then there's someone in the back who's got the loudest voice in the room going, no, they're horrible, let's not do it. And it's the loudest voice in the room, but it's only one voice in the room. It's only one reflection of the interaction we could have with these children, but it's the loudest voice in the room. So do you listen to the loudest voice in the room? We run the risk, if we sit down and are in one sense seduced by this idea of Star Wars and war in space and weapons and wow, that's really exciting and sexy and imagine all of that, if we get seduced by that loudest voice in the room, we are ignoring all those other voices. And exactly as you say, space is about so many things. It's about so many extraordinarily good things. The humanity, where we are today, is so much at a higher level, even despite all of the inequities in the world, and there are many, many problems. But we are at a much better place today than we would be without space. And to threaten that by this loud voice in the room, and I'm not pointing to one country, because all of the major countries are looking at space with increasingly militaristic eyes in different ways. We have some with louder voices than others, but you know, there's no one bad Johnny, but there are many, many other kids in that room. And so we have to, in the debates, we have to say, don't let the loudest voice in the room be the only voice. We have to make sure that everybody understands how incredibly important space is for, in so many ways, and how positive it is. And the other issue is, you talked about mutually assured destruction. And in a sense, that theory stopped the unthinkable. To a certain degree, there are analogies in space, because you've heard me say this on other occasions, but I always compare space to climate change. And you think, okay, climate change, great challenge for the world. In the shortish term, who's going to suffer the most in climate change? It's the poorer countries, the least developed countries, the small island states. You know, over time, of course, we all suffered greatly, but the greatest impact in the earliest stages is to the smaller countries, the poorer countries, the less developed countries. And I generalize, of course, but you get the idea. In space, because the more powerful countries have the greatest infrastructure, the greatest reliability on space, dependency on space, they're also the most vulnerable. So in case of irresponsible behavior in space, they themselves will be the first to suffer, the larger countries. All of them. And so this talk about Space Force and about space being, you know, people just conceive of space using this well-worn mantra of contested, congested, and competitive. We've heard it, you've heard it 1,000 times, right?
Yes.
It's beautiful, you know, 3 C's, it sounds so poetic, but it's nonsense if you think that is the only way we conceive of space. Space is should be conceived of in so many other ways. But if you start talking like that and talking yourself into this idea that we've got to maintain our strength in space, and wait a minute, we're strong in space, which means we're vulnerable in space, which means, hey, we have to defend ourselves, which means, hey, we can't let the other guy do it, hey, which means, hey, we have to destroy them. As you say, it's it could perhaps be self-fulfilling, but ultimately, as you quite rightly say, it's self-defeating as well. Mm. And so even though there are many voices that say things that you and I will disagree with in terms of the way they portray space as this warfighting domain, in the end, we have to listen to all the voices, and common sense, whatever that means, has to prevail. You know, if we don't all play the game, you know, we can be tough, we can be strategic, we can be political, but if we don't all play the game, then at some point we ruin it for all of us. None of us can play the game in space. And therefore we miss out on this incredible, amazing place in so many ways. It's inspirational, it's scientific, it's exploratory, but it also is the future of humanity and the way we live. And so in the end, there's that balance. And our, you know, what I see in my small way is to try to at least say to people, wait a minute, there are many voices about space and we need to listen to them all. And in the end, if the decision makers decide they want to be irresponsible, well, in the end, they're the decision makers, but it's up to us to say, before you do that, you have to listen to every voice in that room and not just the loudest voice. So I completely agree. You say it far more eloquently than I, but I think we're, you know, we may not agree on everything, but I think on this point we totally agree.
Oh, yeah. I think so. And I think also that the thing you say about having to say, no, we need to listen to every voice in the room before we make decisions on this, is so important and something that Australia, I think, needs to be doing. I really think that that's the role that Australia can play in a major way. We've done it in many other areas. And that is to say, well, some countries, you know, the loud voice in the room might have a view of space as being one particular thing because it means that to them. But space is a socially constructed zone too. So every voice in that room actually makes up what space is.
Exactly.
And so making sure that every voice in the room gets equally heard will influence how we think about space and therefore what actions we take. Space is perhaps becoming militaristic in the way that countries think about it, or it has been for a long time. But there's always, I think, a risk that Australia becomes opportunistic when it comes to the militarism side of things. There's a lot of focus at the moment on developing technology, exporting that technology, selling it if at all possible. And I worry a bit, and I'd be really interested to hear your views on this, that, you know, if we're on the one hand running around saying, let's not weaponize space, let's keep it peaceful, let's do science together, and on the other hand, our space agency is sort of spruiking all of the products that we can sell in terms of, you know, CubeSats. Well, on this side, we're worried about debris, but on this side, we're selling all of these nanosats, and isn't it exciting we can launch so many of them at once? Things like that, the one on, you know, saying one thing on one hand and doing something else on the other hand, may undermine that process. I think that that is something that does worry me as I look sort of forward to the next few decades in space. But what would your view be on it?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and you really raise the complexity of the issues involved. So I've done a lot of work for quite a number of governments, for example, on how to either draft or reform their national space law, because as space becomes more commercialized, more and more citizens and corporates get involved in space, and countries need to control is the wrong word, need to regulate that in an appropriate way, particularly under their obligations. And every country I deal with, and I've just been appointed by another country in Northern Europe now, and I exactly, you say the same thing to each of them, because they're all asking the same questions about what is the most appropriate framework to suit us. But the answer to that will be different for every country. In the end, it's a balance. It's a balancing act, and this will depend, therefore, on so many factors. But the balance is pretty easy to state. The application of it will depend on domestic factors that are different in every country. And that balance is, on the one hand, encouraging responsible behaviour, adhering to international principles that virtually every country is bound by, under the treaties and under general international law, and working out a way that deals with space for the future. All of those are great things. On the other hand, encouraging commerce and industry within the country, encouraging entrepreneurship. Many countries would say national security interests, and a whole range of other things. And it's a balancing act. And the appropriate level of regulation will depend on who the country is, what its culture is, what its political views are, what its risk profile is, what sort of activities, what people want, what inspires them about space. And even those headings are very different for every country. So Australia, we have been involved in space for a long time. We were a major space player, if that's the right word, in the very early days through Woomera, which was the second busiest spaceport in the world in the 50s and 60s, in the 60s in particular. People would say historically that space, if you like, pardon the pun, fell off the radar for Australia. And it's sort of been rediscovered in the last two decades, and particularly in the last 4 or 5 years. And we now have an agency established, and as I said in the intro, I had the privilege of working with the expert review group, which essentially formulated a lot of the ideas upon which the agency is based. And I worked with Megan Clark, who's now the CEO of the agency. She's fantastic. But she has said publicly that our agency is the most industry-focused agency in the world. And many will say, and I will agree, that's a positive aspect. But there is a view that is a reflection on the balance of these issues, that space is about industry and commerce. It's about generating revenues. It's about creating jobs. It's about those sorts of issues. Of course, the agency is also very conscious of a range of other things. But, you know, Megan and the industry and the agency is geared around developing the Australian space industry. And indeed, the expert review group that I was a part of that ultimately helped with the formulation of the agency was set up to work out what our space industry capabilities in Australia are and should be going down the track. So that's a particular view of space. And it's true to say that the greatest percentage of spend on space is still done by defence. And so if you want to create an industry and you want to find customers who will pay money, then some elements of that industry will ultimately and inevitably be geared towards defence and military aspects. And so that's a view we have to take. That's a view you have to take. But that's not just about space. It's about many other things. You look at, one of the biggest trades in the world is the armaments trade. And when you have, look at the Saudi Arabia situation with Khashoggi, and I won't form a view about where I stand, but you'll recall that the United States made a strong statement saying, we've just got this huge arms deal with the Saudis, and in a sense that tailors the way we react to the Khashoggi. Now, it's not for me to be judgmental. Obviously, I think you would probably guess my views, but that's not for this program. But if you take a view that that is appropriate, you know, building an industry that to a certain degree is geared around defence, Well, that's a decision that you make. Some other countries look at space in the way they develop their industries in different ways. Science and exploration or other areas of commerce that don't necessarily revolve around defence.
Or but space mining being space a classic mining. Example.
But space mining itself has some particular challenges to it. And we can talk about that, of course. But in the end, it's choosing the right balance. And you mentioned about the small sats, on the one hand worrying about space debris, on the other hand encouraging small satellites. And we have this talk about massive constellations, and people say, don't worry, they will deorbit very quickly, and there's a whole range of issues around that and some guidelines. But again, that's a balance. You know, I've always, when I reviewed the Australian law, I have done for some other countries, I've always tried to say, okay, this might be appropriate for what you want, but we should always encourage responsible behaviour. And we should always be cognizant of the fact that short-term, if you like, gains in developing new types of industries might not necessarily reflect longer-term advantages for us and indeed the way that we deal with space. And so I haven't answered your question because there is no answer. Every country will view it differently. Indeed, when I was involved in talking to governments, and we all think government speaks with one voice, and then you walk around, I'm sure you've done the same, but you walk around any country in the world and you go to the different government departments and you start talking to them about space. Within the government, there are five or six different ways that space is used. You know, you talk to defence. They don't want industry. They don't want to make it easier for private enterprise because for them, it's about the national security and military aspects. You walk down the corridor to the Department of Industry in any country, they say space is about industry and commerce. You walk down the road to the Foreign Affairs Department of any country, they will say, well, space is about our international obligations and being a responsible international citizen, if you like. You walk down to finance and they will say, well, space is about spending appropriately and finding a priority about how we spend our money compared to all the other. So it's very difficult to, in the end, find one view of space. But in the end, that's what you've got to do. And countries have got to do that in determining the way they move forward. And
well, in the end, if you don't decide it, it will be decided for you.
Absolutely.
In the sense that others will perceive things in certain ways and things have actions or reactions, even if they're not intended.
But there are opportunities, for example, for Australia, but for other countries to look at space as stewards. Stewardship. That's a principle that exists in different contexts. But what I mean by that is two ways. You create the way you administer and regulate space in a way that is fluid and ongoing and adaptive. But secondly, you accept that in whatever you do and encourage, you have a greater responsibility than the immediate responsibility of maximising the sovereign purse or whatever it is. And I think there are real opportunities for Australia. Sure, we all want to create industry, we all want to make revenues, we all want to have better lives, we all want the Australian economy to do well. Of course we accept all of that. But there's also an opportunity for leadership for us, and not only us, other countries, but certainly for us. There's leadership for us in the space mining debate that you mentioned, both from a legal perspective, but from a technological perspective, from a political perspective. There's opportunities. There's opportunities in terms of the way we... what are the appropriate space activities? Should we decide that we should do anything in space because we can? The idea, for example, of utilising technology and resources to create love hotels in space. It's an extreme example.
Sure.
But it, again, this is not being prudish or judgmental, but notwithstanding that we're getting better and better at what we do in space, we still have limited resources and limited, and should we be spending part of that precious resources and also utilising part of precious space for love hotels. Or whatever. And again, I apologise, it's a bit of a silly example.
Oh no, I love it. It's great, yeah.
You know, Mir, before it went down, a Japanese consortium really wanted to buy Mir and create it into a honeymoon hotel. Okay, good luck to them, it didn't happen. And do we want humans in space, human settlements? Well, we've had lots of discussion about humans settlements on Mars, although I think Mars is so far off. But the moon is perhaps, in my opinion at least, is far more realistic. And it wouldn't it be great and exciting, and it's part of the frontier and we're all inspired by this. But we have to work out exactly why and what we want to do. You know, Stephen Hawking said that the future of humanity is in space. If he's correct, then maybe we've got to start doing this. But I think we're so sophisticated in what we can do, yet we're still at the beginning, that nobody ever asks the questions, sit back and say, well, what are the appropriate things to do in space? You know, it's a reflection for all of us. Shouldn't we be setting some guidelines, standards, whatever, that say, well, this is the way humanity, you know, with you know, some exceptions, because countries will do things, but this is the way we should move forward, because in the end, it belongs to all of us, and we should, again, you're not going to have collective decision making, but we should be conscious of the fact that of the 500 things that we'll ultimately be able to do in space, perhaps we should be only doing 300 of them or something like that, and concentrating our efforts on that to maximize the benefits that we all get in different ways from space.
Well, it brings us back to our discussion on the differences between having many regulations and then people trying to skirt the edges of them.
Correct.
Versus having a sort of an open a system of regulations that are more gestures, which reminds me very much of you know, talking on the commercial side of things about how space might then interact with financial interests and commercial interests, because generally speaking, finance, particularly after the GFC, is one area that is hugely regulated, and there are whole departments within big financial institutions that exist purely to know the regulations inside out, so that they know how to find the ways around them. So what happens when you take a bunch of people who are trained to think in that way, which is, well, if there's no explicit regulation against it, then let's go, and you let them loose on a place like space, which is this delicate balance of nuance and symbolism and gestures and shared understandings. It's a concerning thing for me, and particularly around the question of mining space. Do we wait until there's a problem or to step in and regulate? Or do we try and regulate in advance and accept the fact that people will find their way around those regulations? And then how does that interact with having colonies that are set up to do that mining? Or is the whole thing done by machines, in which case you still have questions of ethics? Because, as you say, should we really be doing this in the first place? Is this something that we want to spend our resources on? What do you think?
Wow.
I've just thrown a lot of things
at you. Wow. Everybody's scratching their heads. You're actually right. So the space mining debate is front and centre at the moment. It's an issue, but it's not a new, you know this, but perhaps some of your listeners don't, it's not a new debate. Already in the 70s, there was a lot of excitement about the results of analysing the Apollo mission samples that they brought back from the moon. They brought back, I can't remember now, maybe 200 kilos. And actually, the Americans were very generous in sharing that around the scientific community. And there was a lot of excitement, and indeed we have a treaty in the late 70s that explicitly deals with this issue of, if we are going to exploit the hard resources of space, mining asteroids and the moon, at that stage it really was thinking about the moon, but the debate's gone more broadly, then how do we do it? And you and I know historically that treaty, for a whole bunch of essentially political reasons, was not heavily subscribed to, but it came about at a period where similar debates were going on in other domains, like the law of the sea about deep sea mining, and essentially there was this ideological, philosophical divide between the richer industrialized countries who potentially had the technological wherewithal to do these activities, and other countries, largely former colonies, who, because of the legal way we characterize the deep seabed and the high seas, and the legal way we characterize space as, in a sense, belonging to us all — I'm being simplistic, but that's how we sort of characterize it — those colonies, those former colonial countries and smaller countries, didn't like the idea that the larger countries could go and exploit these resources without there being some mechanism for sharing. Mm. So all of that happened, and politically that led to a whole range of difficulties in terms of the treaties. But this space but the point of that is, the space mining debate is not a new — it's not a new argument. It's come back again because there are many companies that have claimed that they're developing their technology. Interestingly, as a side point, a couple of the major ones have recently gone bankrupt in the United States. So others may take their place over time, but the arguments about this is happening, we've got to develop rules now, and if we don't, countries will go ahead on their own, is, as is often the case in debates about space and other areas where technology moves, complete overreaction and ignoring the complexities. Space is hard. Even though it works, it's hard and complex, and things take a long, long, long time to develop. But let's assume the technology does exist down the track. It does give rise to major challenges. We now are confronted by industry who talk about not billions of dollars but trillions of dollars in terms of the potential value of somehow harnessing these hard resources in some commercial way. Mm. And of course, nothing attracts interest more than the potential for a new frontier with pots of gold at the end. As I said, I think it's a long way off, but we have to be careful about the way we talk about space and the way we get excited about that. Because in the end, we have to understand, everything has to be put in context, and the context of space is that it is different, as we've discussed. That we have decided as a humanity that it has certain characteristics in terms of the way we view it, culturally, spiritually, legally. And by suggesting that all of a sudden we can mine these asteroids or the moon. I mean, imagine looking at the moon. There is a film called Moon that was directed, and I've forgotten his name, but directed by David Bowie's son. Mm. I really commend it to you and your listeners. Mm-hmm. Really great movie called Moon, and it's about mining on the moon. And it's got some human issues to it, but these massive machines on the moon. Imagine, not that it would happen, but imagine looking up at the moon and seeing scars on the moon, how that would affect us culturally and philosophically, and it would mean that we would start thinking about space in different ways. And I think that's really dangerous. It's really dangerous because when you start talking about money in those terms, remembering, as I said, that this is not going to happen for a long time, if at all. Mm. But if you start talking about money, that nothing excites people more. And industry is saying, come on, let's go, recognizing that it's not going to happen for a long time. And we just have to be careful that doesn't encourage behavior that is antithetical to the way we view space as something that collectively we have an interest in and deliberately agreed right from the beginning, even by the United States and the Soviet Union, is not subject to the concepts of colonization, because colonization on Earth largely is about resources and has been historically, is not subject to those same sort of forces. So we have to be really, really careful about that. And talking about trillions of dollars is really... you're a former investment banker, I'm a former investment banker. It's a way of encouraging investment. And the way I view it is, it's encouraging. I'm from industry. I say this is going to happen. Look at all the money. Then you get the investment to see whether you really actually can do it or not, whether it is going to happen. So we just have to be careful in the way we talk about it. But my view is on the space mining thing, if ever it gets to the point where industry can do this in a safe way, whatever, at that point, I really do think that the main countries, but then followed by everyone else, will actually sit down and work out the rules, because that issue in particular is so overarching in the way that we would change our perceptions of space, that it's way, 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 way too big for one country or two countries or three countries to be doing it, let alone one or two or three companies.
Yes.
I'm not sure we'll get to that point in my lifetime. We may well get to that point, and then we just have to sit down and work out the appropriate framework. But I'm convinced we can do that. We've done it with other natural resources in space, like the geostationary orbit, which is this incredibly valuable natural resource. Same arguments. It, in a sense, was part of this common heritage that we all own. The larger countries started using it. The smaller countries said, wait for us. And in the end, through, you know, some fierce negotiations, we now have a system which works, which manages the exploitation in a way that is quote-unquote fair. Nothing's entirely fair. But at least it gives rights to everybody. And I think in the end, we've got to find some way of doing this, recognizing that very few countries will ever be able to do this space mining, but we still have to recognize that it belongs, in a sense, to all of us, and we've got to find a way through. And I think we will.
Well, yes, colonization, as you say, is largely about resources. But the problem with colonization is largely about sort of structuralized inequalities, if
Absolutely.
I could make up a word. And when people get excited about trillions of dollars in space mining, you've got to remember that there has to be a buyer and there has to be a seller. And the seller might make trillions of dollars, but the buyer has to be able to afford to buy these things. So we've got a limited pool of potential buyers who have a limited pool of resources. And I think the concerns that the Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Treaty had about avoiding that inequality, whether it was economic or otherwise, and making sure that space was a common heritage for mankind in order to do that, to avoid conflict, have to be front and centre of any kind of regulation of commercial activities in space. Because it's not about stopping people from going out and making money and so on. It's just about making sure that we're not setting ourselves up for massive structural problems as a world community again.
Absolutely. I mean, we even though we don't hear it as much, we talk about the digital divide, right? The internet, in a sense, is a, I don't know how you legally categorize it, and we struggle with it.
Yeah.
But the analogy is there in that the internet haves are able to become stronger and richer, and the internet have nots, and there still is a third of the world's population that doesn't have any access to the internet. And interestingly enough, some space may help to alleviate that to a certain degree, some uses of space. So the divide, the utilization of this thing we call the internet actually exacerbates inequalities if it's not done properly. And your point is absolutely valid, that if we're not careful, the utilization of these hard resources will exacerbate inequalities, because buyer and seller will be wealthy countries. And they say, you know, they have to be proven right, but they say participating in that sort of activity will allow them to do more and more things, which you would think is to their advantage. So we have to be careful that it doesn't exacerbate divides further. I mean, nothing is perfect. We know that there are space haves and space have-nots now, but we don't want to make it even more stark. And I think your point's absolutely right, that if we don't do it properly, if it happens at all, we actually run the risk of making things even more divisive than more unified. And I think in the end, that's to everybody's disadvantage.
We're in furious agreement.
Oh, I know. What can we disagree on?
I'm not sure.
But all of these topics are important.
Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I think they're hugely important. And the fact that we agree is actually fine. You know, people go on and on. I used to do debating and teach debating, and debating's great. But ultimately, reaching a consensus is what it's all about.
Yeah, but I hope it's not too boring for you. I mean, we should be arguing and going, what a load of rubbish and all of that. But on this point, I mean, I'm sure there are lots of people who will listen to us, particularly on the war fighting domain, or the fact that perhaps we should stop and smell the roses a bit and work out what we're going to do. A lot of people will disagree with that.
Oh, absolutely. But the debate will happen.
Yeah, and I'm sure you will hear from many listeners who say, what an idiot that guy was.
Oh, that's right. I'll direct them straight to you.
And I'll direct them back to you because we're in agreement.
Stephen, I think we should finish because I suspect that you have to make dinner or something.
I probably do.
But thank you so much.
Oh, you're
it's
welcome.
Been a really wonderful chat, and hopefully listeners enjoy it as much as I have, which is a lot. My brain feels very stretched in all sorts of interesting directions. So it's really been fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for just being such an incredible ambassador, as you are, for all things good about space, because you are. And listeners, she's great.
Okay. Thank you. You've been listening to Space Junk. If you would like to find out more about space law or the history, philosophy, and sociology of science, you can follow me on Twitter at ahandmer. That's A for Annie, H-A-N-D-M-E-R. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsitis.
I'm Kayla Tsinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.